All right, we're live. This is our episode number one.
The inaugural episode.
Yeah, two dads in a pod. I never asked you about your opinion on the title, I guess.
Well, I like it. I will say I like it a lot better than what was the other one? Two dads, one mic.
It was two dads, one pod.
One pod. Oh, okay. Well, either way, that's a little too on the nose. If you grew up in the 90s and 2000s during the early
Yeah,
internet days.
I don't think it would be a very family podcast if we had chose that. You know what's wild is that
Yeah.
there was another podcast called that. It was like two dads in one pod, and I was
Look,
surprised.
more power to them.
Yeah, they had an Insta. I think I showed you. I think they had an Instagram page too. But
Yeah.
I was gonna ask you. So, what's the vibe this week? If you had to describe your week, it's Saturday. How did the last week go for you?
Oh man, the last week, it seems like each week becomes a little bit more hectic. And I spend most of my time realistically working, right? And I don't work more than 40 hours a week. That's just the majority of the time that I'm awake during the week. You know what
Yeah.
I mean? So yeah, it seems to be getting more and more hectic as more responsibilities are being tacked on. But kind of roll with it. And I've got some pretty good mentors. So, it's all uncharted territory.
I like the word that you use, mentor. We'll talk a little bit more about that on another podcast, but I don't want to go off too tangent, but I had some thoughts there. My vibe this week. So I'm actually coming back to my old job. I moved to Texas and now back to my old job. And I gotta say, it's one of those things you don't know what you have until you're gone, and or some, until you lose it. And I'm glad that I didn't lose it. I took a little break from it, now coming back. So I forgot how nice I have it. When I left and when I was like, I don't know how to describe it, but I would say I feel grateful and I do feel rejuvenated with this creative idea of podcast. I think it definitely, I was looking for it like this entire week. I was like, this is exciting, so thanks for
I don't
giving
know if you listen to Joe Rogan or not, but I listen to episodes of his on occasion. And I don't remember which episode it was, but there was, I think it's on numerous occasions. He has mentioned that he never started a podcast with the intention of making it big or making a bunch of money. It was just kind of like what you said, a creative outlet to hang out and have good conversations. And, I like that idea. I like that perspective on it.
Yeah, I think it would be fun to have guests, and on our podcast someday. But what did you think of the Olympics? We just finished the Paris Olympics. What did you think of it? Did you get a chance to see any events?
Watched a little bit. I know that, China took a gold in the men's 100-meter freestyle. And, swimming, of course, is close to my heart as I swam in high school. And I competed as well in high school, and I was pretty decent at it, being a 6'3", pretty skinny guy. But nowhere near the speed that these people can swim, right? Like, I think this guy, I don't know how to pronounce the name, but from China, swam 100 meters, which in an Olympic sized pool is two laps, 50 meters down, 50 meters back, in like 46 seconds. And that is just absurd.
I was going to say, thank you for explaining that, because, you know, I ran track and I do remember you swimming, actually. You know, I think we had a couple of mutual friends that were in this swim team. But so it's two laps. Okay. It's 50 meters, right? You said each lap, right? And yeah. To put it into perspective, how fast is your high school team or a college team?
Honestly, I don't even remember what my fastest time was. Personally, I did the 50-yard sprint. That was one of my events. And so the public pools generally don't have Olympic-sized swimming pools. So they're oftentimes 25 yards long. So a 50-yard sprint would be one lap down, one lap back. And I want to say that one is in I don't even know. I'd have to track that down some way, but it's probably on the order of 30 seconds or something.
So it would be basically a minute for 100 yards, and the Olympian from China, he got 46 seconds. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Dang.
Yeah, 46 seconds. And then beat his own record in the men's 4x100.
Uh-huh.
Where it's a relay. You know, there's relays in track as well. But yeah. Each person of four swims a lap down and a lap back. And in that 100-meter dash, his part of the relay, he broke 46 seconds and did 45 and some change.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is crazy.
That is crazy. The one that I actually am a huge fan of swimming, some of the swim races, because I think it's pretty cool to, you know, to be able to swim so fast, right? Whenever I swim, I'm not a great swimmer, but whenever I swim, it's there's so much technique to it. I think with running, not that it's any easier, but swimming, you know, breathing, you have to get breathing down, and it's a full body workout, and you're burning so many calories, and you have to produce a lot of heat to keep your muscles, you know, going, and the soreness after is different than when I run. So I'm pretty impressed with swimmers, people that can swim.
I was thinking about this either today or yesterday. I think about this a lot, actually. How I was in the best shape of my life when I swam five nights a week.
Uh-huh.
And you know, kind of like what you were saying earlier, you don't know what you've got till it's gone. I hated doing that five nights a week.
Yeah.
You know, I always felt pretty good after the fact, you know, get a good workout in and you've got basically runner's high, but for a swimmer, and go home and eat 1500 calories.
Yeah.
But yeah, man, I was in the best shape of my life then. Of course, I'm 15 years older now, but
yeah.
But yeah, I would love to get back to that someday. The other thing I'll say about the Olympics, though, and totally off topic of swimming, but maybe I haven't been paying attention over the last Olympic years, but this one in particular, and maybe this is just kind of online society in general, but this one in particular, I've never seen the level of memification that exists with this one today. It's ridiculous. And I'm here for it.
That's awesome. Was there a meme in particular that you were thinking of, or?
well, all of them seem to be centered around the Australian breakdancer.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, like, who am I to say or to judge or anything, you know, because she's obviously made it to a the Olympic level in some fashion. But,
yeah. Hey, it counts. Counts.
Yeah.
I guess my question to you would be, if you could be good at any event, what event would it be? Would you say swimming?
I think so. Yeah. I used to, I don't know if you'd call it a saying, but when I did swim, I used to say that I wasn't very coordinated when it came to land sports. Mm-hmm. You know, I tried baseball. I never did try football, but I mean, you know, of course, played like mud football and
sure
flag football and stuff on occasion. But, you know, the only other one, and I don't even know if this is an Olympic event, it'd be cool if it were, is ultimate frisbee and disc golf.
Oh, that sounds, yeah.
Oh, man, there's nothing like throwing a frisbee. I love that. But yeah, I think it'd be swimming for me. It always had a special place for me.
Would you do sprints or would you do relay or all of it? Like long distance, what would be, if it was like, okay, this is my event, like what event would that be?
It would probably be the, let's see, what did I do? I often did the 50-yard sprint. The 100-yard breast was a good one. I am a big fan of the breaststroke.
I was going to say, I won't say it.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like what you were saying earlier. Like, it comes down to technique. There's a certain technique. Like, I suck at butterfly. Mm. Never could pick up the technique. I can do it. Maybe not today, but I could do it. Yeah. But, you know, there was just other people who just had that body motion and that coordination down a lot better than I ever could. And generally speaking, at least at the high school level, you know, Olympians probably are a different story, but at the high school level, a lot of people who were good at butterfly were not very good at breaststroke and vice versa. So if folks were good at breaststroke, they weren't
Harry, you broke off a little bit. Are you there?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah, it's better. Go ahead.
What was the last thing you heard?
You were saying something about breaststroke. I mean, you did about breaststroke for some time, but you were saying like the technique and you could do it, but.
Yeah. So like for like generally speaking at the high school level, at least in my experience, people who were good at butterfly were not very good at breaststroke and vice versa. And that was definitely the case for me. Like, I sucked at butterfly. So yeah, it'd probably be breaststroke for me and definitely the sprints. I was not a fan of the long distance ones.
That's interesting, because I always pictured you as a long distance, being tall, slender. I mean, you're muscular, but definitely thought you were more of a long distance. I guess that's what I saw when I ran track. But I guess for swimming it would be a little bit different.
What about you? If you had to choose an event, what would it be?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. actually, it may come surprise to you, but when I'm at Madison, sorry, there's always a story behind something that I have to say, but when I'm at Madison, there were two events that, so I've always been a huge fan of Olympics, and probably the reason we're talking about this. So the two events that I was really interested in was archery and road cycling. And I actually had a bow. I had a Hoyt bow and used to go target shooting, and it was a lot of fun. Actually, it's a lot of fun. There's a place
That's
in
awesome.
There's a place in Windsor where we kind of grew up. And I used to go there in the first thing in the morning and go shoot and kind of start my day off that way. So I really like archery. The second one was road cycling. You probably already know this, but I have a road bike that I spent like quite a bit of money on, my Trek. And I've always been impressed with cyclists in that they can go for so long, right? And the amount of dedication that it takes, right? The weight and age and like height and kind of the training that you need to be a cyclist is very difficult. I mean, it requires a lot of discipline. And I would say that's with every sport there, but every event. But I've seen with like cyclists, it's like 6 hours of cycling, right? And
yeah, it's crazy.
You watch the Tour de France. I would say Tour de France, it's more difficult than the Olympics, but still, you know, I always thought the Olympics, the road cycling event was always very interesting. And I always imagined myself someday that, you know, to do it. But then I looked up the age of some of these people and like their height and weight and like the training. And my wife's coughing here. You okay? So I would say, so Madison and I were thinking that at the LA 2028 Olympics, I don't think I will go for cycling, but if, you know, I can find a coach and muster up the energy and discipline, I actually think I would consider doing archery. I think it's
really?
Yeah, because it's something that I've always enjoyed. And United States has not won in a while, actually. I don't know if it's ever won in archery. But
is that something that you've kept up on? Like, do you still do it today?
So I lost my bow got stolen at UC Davis. And we actually are thinking that next weekend we might go to a archery place and kind of look at bows and see if that would be something we're interested in. And I did go on a bike ride today and came back from my bike ride. And I thought to myself, there's no way that at age, you know, mid 30, I'm going to be able to be in that shape, especially with my job and with a baby on the way. I mean, I could do it. No, I wouldn't say I could do it, actually. I don't think I have it in me to put that kind of discipline, energy, and time and money to chase after that. But the archery, on the other hand, I feel like that's something I can create in my, and like the, you know, I can buy the bow and arrow and read the books and find a coach and actually dedicate some time to that. So I was actually thinking archery, but we'll see. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
I had no idea you were into archery. I think that's fascinating. I too love archery.
Really?
Haven't done it in a while. Yeah, man. I you know, for whatever you think about Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts, of which I was a member of both.
Yeah.
They give kids an early exposure to that type of thing, which was really cool. You know, I was shooting bows and arrows and shotguns and literal muskets from like the 1700s when I was like maybe
gunpowder
13 years old. Yeah, 10, 11, 12, 13 years old, literally with the gunpowder where you have to, you know, you push it down with a little stick and you get the wad of paper in there and the actual musket ball.
That's so funny. Oh, man. I just can't imagine.
Yeah,
so
that's yeah, those things are loud, man. They are loud. But, yeah, I like archery. And, I mean, certainly the technology behind the bows has come a long way, too.
Did you ever – so, okay, have you ever shot a Hoyt or, like, a recurve bow? Like, as
I don't know enough about them to know what that is. I have shot a compound bow. I know what that is.
Yeah.
That was within the last, like, maybe 2 years I did that.
Really? That's so cool. So I actually had a compound bow too, and I actually had to return that one, because it had some malfunction, and then I was just like, oh, I don't think I have the time to do it. I'm, you know, headed off to, you know, graduate school and whatnot. So I was like, okay, I guess I gotta put down my archery career here. But the recurve bow, I miss it. I miss it a lot, actually. So, yeah, we'll see. But did you see did you see the news on the Turkish shooter with, like, no equipment whatsoever, and he
was coming out like a boss. If he has any daughters, I'm married, so I wouldn't date them anyway, but I'd be afraid to date them if he had any daughters.
Yeah. And the crazy thing is, I think there was a lesson in that, actually. I think, or at least, you know, I thought it was very interesting that how much of that is mental rather than, I guess, tools, right? Like, I was thinking about that the other day. I said, there's a difference between tools and material things. We buy tools and we think that they will increase our productivity and actually improve us as, you know, in our career, in our personal lives, but then they just end up being material things. And this guy basically showed that, you know, you don't need necessarily all these material things. And you have what you have, you make the best of what you have, and you go from there. At least that's the way I interpreted it. But
yeah.
What are your thoughts?
That makes me think of, I agree with you. That totally off topic, but I think there's a parallel here. I not too long ago went down a YouTube rabbit hole on woodworking, and for like weeks was just watching videos about woodworking. And, you know, there are some really talented people out there who can do a lot with literally just like a chisel. And yet there are all of these tools like table saws and miter saws, and you can make all sorts of jigs and things with both of those. And you can do some really cool stuff. But at the end of the day, like there's a certain skill involved in it, and the best of the best can do everything that one could do with all of the best tools with just the minimal amount of tool, you know. Yeah.
I think that says something about about us as humans, that if we put our mind into something, and you know, that sounds very cliche, but I think that Turkish shooter proved a point there, that if you put your mind to something and you really want to do it, you don't need a lot of things. You just need yourself. And I think that's why, going back to starting this podcast, just kind of raw dogging it without anything, you know, no mic, no software, you know, other than the Zoom, and just using that to have a creative outlet and use bare minimum to improve our skills, to get to know each other and to get to know others and to connect with the community that we are going to build and to our society, I think you don't need a whole lot in life. And I will say that as an immigrant, I always thought that material things gave me an advantage. And there is certain truth to that. I think there are tools that you need in life to have an advantage, right? But
for sure.
So I guess that goes into our next topic, actually. So I was listening to the CEO of NVIDIA, and he was asked, will AI replace human jobs? And he said, no, but the human that uses AI will replace a human that doesn't use AI. And I thought that was interesting, because he was saying there is a need of tools in your professional life and in your personal life. And those tools, if efficiently used, can give you a great advantage. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's a really astute observation, and I agree with that. And actually, I wrote a paper about this, if you can believe it, about...
I do believe it, Chad. I do believe it.
The whole scare tactic of, AI's going to take our jobs. I wrote a paper about, is AI actually going to take our jobs? And am I qualified to talk about that? Probably not as qualified as many other people. But what I found, at least in the research I did, is that, you know, if you think back to the invention of like the internet or the computer, maybe a better example, the invention of the car, right? That, in a way, replaced the jobs of those who like made wagon wheels or who shoed horses, right? But it didn't just replace them with nothingness. It replaced those jobs with new jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And just like with AI, I think that's going to be the same thing, right? Where yes, AI is going to take some jobs away. It's already very effective at coding, for example. It's not quite there yet, but it's pretty good. But like, is that going to take the job of a software engineer? Maybe the most entry level, sure, eventually, you know, 10 years down the road, possibly. But what it's creating is exactly what you mentioned, is jobs where people are more highly skilled with and trained on using the AI, or even jobs where people are creating the AI, right? So it's just different jobs. So like in the wagon and the car example, the jobs for like creating the wagon wheel and shoeing the horses and everything, those were replaced with like mechanics, right? Like with the invention of the car, that's a whole new world of work that needs to be done with a whole different skill set.
Yeah. I think what I found interesting about AI, you know, the ChatGPT dropped, and I didn't really get into it right away because, you know, I wanted to, I'm always hesitant to try new things just because like you go into a rabbit hole and then it's not fully mature yet and you're confused. There's a lot of fine tuning that needs to be done. And with limited time, obviously you're like, okay, I will set out a time to actually explore this and, you know, enjoy it and kind of understand. And I thought it was somewhat going to be like what, you know, coding, right? It's a different language. So I didn't jump into AI right away because I thought it would have a coding component to it, which I wouldn't understand because, you know, ChatGPT, you know, 5 years, if you asked someone, what is ChatGPT, they wouldn't know. And they, if, you know, if they had an idea, they would say it's something to do with coding. And to me, I find that very intimidating, actually, someone who's not in the field. But when I finally tried it, I found it actually, I found it, I think revolutionary is the word I guess I would use. One of the, I don't know who said this, but they said it's the fourth industrial revolution. And to me, I think that's cool because, you know, the last time I remember being this excited about any like piece of technology or anything was when I think when Siri first came out. I remember when Siri first came out, I was working at AT&T, and the idea that you have a personal assistant that can look up things, that can do little things here and there. I thought there was so much potential there. And I thought that was very cool. And I was very intrigued by that. I thought that was revolutionary. But after that, I don't recall any, like I can't recall at the moment, but I don't remember anything that revolutionary, you know, since then. Yeah, the cameras have gotten better. The screens have gotten better. The chips have gotten faster and they have better memory and whatnot. But I don't remember it being as revolutionary as Siri at that point, and then now AI. And I remember I was listening to Mark Zuckerberg say this, and he said that we're going to have a lot of assistants, you know, like personal assistants, and they're going to do different things. And I thought that was a really cool idea. We've gone from just Siri on your phone to maybe having assistants everywhere in your Word document or your Excel or in your phone, and it's a little bit crazy. It's a little bit intimidating, but also can be scary. But I think it'd be cool to be able to go to work and to not have to do administrative tasks and have an assistant that does that for you. And now you take every employee or every colleague that you know, and they are using an assistant. Right, even in your personal life, if you could use an assistant to do things that you don't want to do, and how much time that would save, and how much, you know, what can you accomplish? So, I wanted to hear your thoughts on that, and your thoughts on AI.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is kind of a weird example or thought, but what's coming to mind for me is, I don't know if you've seen the videos of, I think it might even be the Tesla robot, but there's a video of a robot.
Oh, is it the Optimus?
Maybe. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But the video is of the robot, and there's a human directing the robot and asking questions. And the robot is standing in front of a sink with like a drying rack for some dishes. And the guy asks the robot, based on the context of this scene, where do you think that dish goes? And the robot picks up the dish and says, well, it goes with the other dishes in the drying rack. And there are a couple of other examples and things, but what that makes me think of, and to your point of kind of freeing up time, you know, I'm in the garage at the moment, and I've got a stack of cardboard boxes that need to be broken down.
Yeah, right? Same, actually.
And it's like a, you know, with it's a never-ending process. But the point is, if there were, and this is kind of going from the virtual to the physical, but if there were an assistant, like a robot, for example, that could break down these boxes, then how much time is that going to save me where I could be doing something else, like recording a podcast or spending time with family?
Yeah.
You know, some of the things that are arguably a lot more important and valuable and worthwhile than breaking down some cardboard.
Sure. And it's not that you don't ever want to break down cardboard boxes. Maybe you don't. I don't know. But like, I have boxes in the garage too to be broken down, and I don't mind, you know, getting a workout in or to stay active. And but there are times when you're just like, I want my house to be clean. Speaking of that, I do have those vacuum robots. We have two of them, one upstairs and one downstairs. And Chad, when I tell you, that is one of my favorite piece of equipment in the house. I love that thing. And I was telling Madison.
We've got one too.
Yeah. And it mops, it vacuums. And I was telling Madison, I said, you know, if there was ever a robot that we could buy to do, you know, our dishes and things here and there. You're in the middle of the night if you need a glass of water, right? And you're upstairs and you're like not wanting to go downstairs. We would buy one. Obviously, there's a price tag that, you know, we won't pay to, you know, we wouldn't want to pay, you know, above a certain price, but you know, it's one of those price to value ratio. Okay, well, what's the price and how much value can I get out of that? So I'm actually very excited about that. And then I don't know if you've been to the NVIDIA website. If you get a chance, I highly encourage it. What are the things that they're looking into or the things that their chip can do? Again, I'm a novice at this. So, but with, I was watching the YouTube video and basically I can't even explain it. It's so advanced, but, you know how they build manufacturing, like buildings and whatnot. And they have these robots to build, like, let's say, you know, it's Tesla cars, for instance. And in that facility, there is humans, there's also robots, and there's also just, you know, equipment that are not robots. And how do they, where are they placed, and how do they interact with each other and in like space and time? And their like AI chip can not only create the factory, like kind of the design or whatever, to be efficient, but they can also create they also created a simulation where to see how they can get the most efficiency. You know, if you were to move this robot here, and if you were to move this person here, and what would the world look like that, and how could we increase productivity? And they could do all that before they have put down a single brick of actually building the facility. I thought that was very cool, actually.
That's a really interesting application.
Yeah,
I could see how that would potentially save companies a lot of money.
Well, then if you think about it now, take it into a healthcare model, right? If you could simulate, actually autonomous driving was the other example they gave. They were able to simulate like, you know, a child crossing the street or, you know, car accidents. They can simulate all that and kind of put, and they can, they're doing the simulation without actually having these autonomous driving cars on the street. And they so advanced that I can't even explain it, but they're able to simulate all that on their supercomputers, so they don't actually have to have physical cars out in the real world, you know. So they can simulate all that and then go from there and make autonomous driving even more efficient and safer. And then the other thing is, if you take that same idea to like healthcare, for instance, right? If you have a patient, let's say, having a heart attack or a stroke out in the field, and now you got to send help, and then you got to have them come to the hospital, and then in the ER, and then the ER, you know, you run the simulation of where the patient information is transferred from the EMT to the nurse, and then from the nurse to the physician, and then from the ER physician to the cardiologist or the neurologist, and, you know, from the first floor to, let's say, the fifth floor, how that simulation, how that would work, and then getting that patient, getting that patient under anesthesia so you could pull the clot out. If you could simulate all that and improve it rather than having to do studies, you know, from the real life model and see where things would be efficient and would save life, if you could do that in a simulation, think about where this world would be. And then same thing with, like, kids' education, right? Like, where should kids sit? Where would it improve their learning? You know, homeschooling. I mean, the world could really be transformed, hopefully for the good, that AI does that. But it has a lot of potential. Yeah, what do you think? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it really all comes down to just eking out that next little drop of productivity and efficiency. That's what it boils down to in every single case.
Yeah. What are you most excited about? I mean, you're in the field more than I am. What are you excited about?
Yeah, there's a lot to be excited about. And admittedly, I'm not quite in the AI or machine learning field as much as I am just in the regular old web development field.
Yeah.
And that's also the case for the Twitter algorithm or X algorithm that I've kind of, I mean, obviously I haven't created it for myself, but based on who I follow and the posts that I interact with, that's the algorithm trends me toward web development. But something that I have seen in the last few months, and I believe this is from a company called Vercel, who had some pretty big shakeups in the web development industry over the last couple of years, but they recently came out with an AI powered, essentially an AI powered UI builder, where you have a prompt and you type in what you want. Say it's like you want a blue button that says this, that has this particular animation when you click it. And it will go and create that and essentially spit out the code that you can literally copy and paste into your project. And I think that's just amazing. And I find that really interesting. How would you even develop that? You know, that's yeah. Just fascinating.
What is that? So again, from an outsider perspective, does that mean more efficiency in your work? And does that mean, like, I know a little bit about coding, but does that mean that there are less errors and, like, you don't have to go back and go through the code because you know it was done by AI, that it would be efficient, it would be, it wouldn't be as erroneous? Or what, how can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, I don't think that it's quite to the level of being able to trust it completely, that it wouldn't solve for every error case or not have bugs in it, for example. But for something as small as a button or just a little piece of UI like that, and if you're trying to move quickly, sure, that could provide a lot more efficiency. I tend to be the type of person who wants to understand the code that I'm using. So it's probably going to be less efficient for me as opposed to somebody who just wants to drop the code in and move on. You know, I'm going to copy and paste it and then try to understand it. And that kind of, I mean, that's both a little bit of my OCD and perfectionism, but also just comes from experience of working on a large team on a very large code base, where it kind of behooves me to understand the code that I'm working with in case I need to come back and do something with it, whether that's fix it or improve it or change it in some way later on.
That's interesting. Speaking of AI and efficiency and user interface, what are your thoughts on NVIDIA and the Palantir company in terms of, you know, being an investor? You know, I actually bought some shares of NVIDIA. I think I told you a while back, and I sold them for profit. But their earnings reports come out on, I think, August 28th. What are your thoughts on that, on those two companies and whatnot?
So I was a little bit of a fanboy at Palantir for a little while. Yeah, I actually applied to Palantir when I was looking for jobs right out of college. And it was very sad when they didn't take me up on my application. And
missed out on you, man.
Yeah, it's a very competitive industry and company, you know. And honestly, I think it worked out for the better anyway, because getting a security clearance for doing government contracts, you know, think what you will about it, but at the most base level, it's kind of a pain in the ass, getting a security clearance and all of that. It's very invasive from what I hear. So I'm content where I am on that front. But to your question, though, something that I find interesting but also scary is that, you know, as these companies like NVIDIA and Google and Apple and these major tech companies grow, they take up a larger and larger portion of the stock market, particularly the tech industry. And also NVIDIA in particular, because of their focus on AI, like everything is about AI now.
Yeah.
And it's so pervasive at this point. It's almost like if you're launching something new that has to do with tech, if you don't have AI powering some portion of it and you're not marketing that, you're kind of behind the times. Hmm. And what's scary about that is that as all of these new companies and these existing companies begin to pivot more toward AI, the fact that NVIDIA has such a strong, I guess you could say, like a bear hug around a lot of the AI market, that means that a lot of the tech industry is kind of riding on NVIDIA.
Yeah.
Right? So NVIDIA crashes, it's going to pull a whole bunch of stuff down with it.
Yeah. But in the same, but I also, my rebuttal to that, just to play a devil's advocate, is that I'm glad that it's not Meta, Tesla, or Google, or Microsoft. And my argument for that is that it's nice to see a new name. You know, it was the FANG, you know, there was this era of, you know, FANG stocks. And NVIDIA was nowhere near that. It was growing, but, you know, it wasn't as mainstream. But now you have NVIDIA. And so, and now that you have Palantir, and then now CrowdStrike is kind of becoming more popular after the debacle not too long ago. So, yeah, I agree that they hold a huge market share on AI, but I also think they are making, they're also kind of setting the standard where, like Apple, they have their own like Apple Intelligence, and then Microsoft, and then is working on their stuff, and then Google has Gemini, and then Meta has Llama. I think the first one to grow is not necessarily the one that stays, right? Like MySpace was, you know, the first kind of the big social media, and now nobody even talks about MySpace, and there's like all these other companies. So
yeah, you're really dating us here, man.
Yeah. But I think, yeah, in some ways I'm happy that it's not the, you know, the Amazon and Google. I think there was enough controversy there, and there's also God knows what else, what kind of skeletons they have in their closet. So it's nice to have a fresh new company, and it shows that capitalism, I mean, again, you could say that it doesn't work, but it could say that in some ways it does work, that there is competition, and maybe these companies will hold each other accountable, and they'll do the responsible things. So I don't know. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I agree to an extent. I have maybe a little bit of personal experience with this. One of my teammates not too long ago actually left my team to go work at NVIDIA.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And at the time, it was kind of like, I couldn't really understand the decision. You know, like I could understand why it maybe wasn't such a great fit on our team. You know, no particular person was at fault or anything, just the dynamic just wasn't quite right. But you know, why go there? Right. And now I can kind of see, well, you know, maybe that decision worked out pretty well for that person.
Yeah.
Probably did. You know, and I think that's directly to the topic of, competition, right? You get competition in the tech industry, you got to step up your game for keeping your employees, or yeah, else they're going to go to where the more interesting projects and more interesting companies are.
I guess maybe I misunderstood what you were saying. Are you saying that if you're not doing AI, then, or if you're not marketing that, then you're not valued, I guess? Or are you saying that it's kind of becoming, when social media was becoming popular and everyone was on social media and it was just kind of just getting annoying at some point, you're just like, okay, enough, you know, I just want to be,
yeah,
are you saying that or what am I missing here?
I'll rephrase. So as companies continue to pivot and push toward AI, that implicitly makes them more dependent upon AI-focused companies like NVIDIA. And as they become more vertically integrated with that type of thing, their valuation and their profits and their progress depend a lot more on that of companies like NVIDIA. So as time goes on, sure, over AI that NVIDIA has, they're going to be more or less carrying the entire tech industry. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because they hold the keys to AI that all of these other companies are using for their products and to be marketable and profitable. But yeah, if something goes wrong with NVIDIA, then the rest of these companies that are so dependent on them.
Yes. I agree. Okay, I see what you're saying. I agree with that, actually. And I see where you're coming from, and I would agree with you. So going back to, there was a news where Microsoft and Meta were going to use the chips that NVIDIA makes. And I agree with you that in the outside, you know, from far, far away, it looks like, oh yeah, NVIDIA is another company that's, you know, becoming part of the you know, the stock market, and it's a publicly traded company and whatnot. But when you look into the details, it's actually all these other companies are, the other six companies are using NVIDIA, and they don't have their own chip. And I think Apple was the one that broke off with Intel, and they have their own chip. But I wonder if other companies are doing that, where they have their own AI chip. But I see.
If they don't, then they, in my humble and very uneducated opinion, are doing themselves a disservice. I think Apple has been very smart about that type of thing, and I think they probably made a very good choice in developing that internally. Not only for the dependence or lack thereof on other companies, but also just for, you know, NVIDIA has to make a chip that can be marketable to everybody. But Apple, on the other hand, if they're making chips for themselves, then they can fine tune and tweak everything exactly as they would like it, you know, and make it work exactly the way that they want it to be as high performing as possible for exactly what their computers and phones need them to be.
Yeah, I would agree with that. The but I do want to jump into our next topic. I'm sure we could probably talk about AI and technology, since we're both very interested in it. What was it? You know, my wife's pregnant, and we're actually 18 weeks now, 18 weeks and 2 days. Thank you. I was going to ask you, did you notice any changes in yourself when your wife became pregnant? And I'm asking this a very vague question, because I want to kind of hear your opinion on it before I, you know, direct you into a direction here.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I didn't really notice too many differences while Lizzie was pregnant. It happened very fast. Like those 9 months went by in a flash. And before we knew it, we had, she did all of the hard work. She brought this beautiful baby girl into the world, and suddenly our worlds were completely different. And I remember thinking, you know, I was fortunate enough to take some time for paternity leave. And I remember thinking, maybe like 2 weeks into that leave, as I started to get a little closer to having to go back to work, and I love my job. I love coding, right? But found myself thinking, like, man, I don't want to go back to work. I want to spend time with our daughter. I want to spend time with Lizzie and with the family. And on top of that, you know, now it's not just Lizzie and I that we have to worry about. We've got a tiny human to worry about as well. So our future security became a lot more important to me and a lot more front of mind. So that's definitely been changed.
So what you described is exactly what my sister described when she was, when she had her first child and she was struggling with going back to work, and she loves her job. My sister is probably the most type A person I know. And I remember she had gotten into fellowship. She finished her residency and she got into fellowship, and she's a super, super smart woman. And it was always her dream to be a stroke specialist. And she loves her job, worked very hard for it, trained in New York, you know, got into Cedar Sinai, you know, big hospital, very hard to get in. She had interviews at Stanford and whatnot. And I remember her going into fellowship, and it was only 3 weeks in where she decided that it wasn't for her. Again, I don't know the whole story, but I do remember one of the factors being that she wanted to be with my nephew. But the reason I asked you that question earlier was because so there's obviously like the hormonal change that women go through, you know, with pregnancy, estrogen, progesterone, oxytocin, and there's also another one, relaxin. But so men go through changes as well. And I have noticed that in myself in the last 5 months that we have been pregnant. So I looked this up. This is from USC website, University of Southern California. And I was talking to my boss about this. And what I found was that dads show greater empathy and affection when they are in that like stage of pregnancy. Not only that, then I, you know, kind of on the rabbit hole there, it said, quote, dad's brains also change with increase in gray and white matter in areas linked to affectionate care and threat detection, as well as those responsible for problem solving and planning. So, I mean, I would say I'm a fairly empathetic person. I do have a kind of a side, you know, that's kind of like tough love. And, but I would say I'm not like, it's not like I'm, don't have any remorse or, you know, struggle with empathy or anything. But I noticed that I was becoming less and less empathetic, you know, as you grow older. But then as soon as we heard the news of pregnancy and we became pregnant, I noticed that I became almost like very empathetic and more understanding. I was able to mentalize emotions better and read emotions better. And that was interesting. And then the second component was the threat detection. So I would say that, you know, I'm not very good with threat detection. You know, I think I'm almost too optimistic and think I live in this idealistic world in my head that, you know, people are good and they have good intentions. And I would like to think that that's always true, but that's not always true. There are people that do terrible things, and that's just the world we live in, unfortunately. And I've noticed that I'm able to detect threat and really think about that a lot, actually. And I think I spend a lot of time thinking about it. And like, for instance, we have like road construction going on near our house, and there's been an accident every week because of somebody, you know, just not cutting up at the front and causing everyone to, you know, pump the brakes, and then downstream there's an accident. And I wouldn't say I'm a reckless driver or anything, but I do, you know, drive above the speed limit every now and then. And but now I am very, very cautious. And not just for myself, but like three or four cars down ahead of me and behind me. You know, Madison makes fun of me for knowing the driver's handbook. You know, I know the rules and the guidelines and like, you know, how far you should be driving, how many seconds and whatnot. So I'm fairly good at that. But now my threat detection has gotten to the next level. That didn't used to be the case. Did you notice those kind of things as well, or am I just going crazy?
You know, I don't think I noticed those in myself. I mean, I would like to think that I'm a fairly empathetic person to begin with. But I will say that once we had our daughter, that it's no longer about me, you know, and realistically, it never should just be about me in a partnership. But now there's, you know, two adults are only dependent upon each other for so much, whereas a child is completely dependent upon the adult or adults in their life. Right. And that kind of changes my perspective a little bit, where, you know, it's like, and the other thing I'll say is that our daughter is a firecracker. She's spicy. She is a true Aries. Mm-hmm. And I said to my wife the other day, I think somebody got confused when I was born, and like I was born on a different date or something, because I don't actually think I'm an Aries after meeting our daughter. She was born 2 days before my birthday.
Yeah.
And she is the epitome of a fire sign. But what that's taught me is that she's having so many emotions that she doesn't understand and doesn't know how to deal with. And quite frankly, there are emotions that I still don't know how to deal with as a, you know, as an adult man in my 30s. But, you know, that teaches me a little bit more empathy, because she's just a kid having a rough time sometimes.
Yeah.
And trying to figure out what this world is about and trying to understand why she's feeling this way. And yeah, so that's definitely been a change. But that happened after she was born.
Yeah. I was reading a book on children's mental health, and they said, they did a research and they found that children with warm parents, warm and affectionate parents, tend to be popular kids, actually. So there's like four types of kids in school. There's rejected, controversial, neglected, and popular. And they found that popular kids, they can be popular because of athletics and looks, but they can also be popular because if their parents are warm, then they are good with their emotions, and they're warm to other kids and their cohort, and they become more popular that way. And I thought that was an interesting study. Because I feel like if with parents working so much, and if they don't have time with their kids and to be warm with them, it actually could affect kids. You know, they're not that every kid has to be a popular kid, but the other three categories where they're rejected, neglected, and controversial, I feel that could create an environment for other kids in school where it affects their learning and their ability to connect. And so going back to like empathy with kids, I think that's very important. And I think what's also important is, again, we'll talk about this through our podcast, is role modeling. Role modeling is so important. If kids are seeing mom and dad not be empathetic towards each other and towards their, you know, their friends and relatives, then they act out in some ways. And so I'm glad that my brain is changing in a lot of ways, because I don't want to have, you know, kids that are not empathetic towards other kids. And And who doesn't want popular kids? And not only that, I think it's important to, I think the next era of next generation has to be more empathetic, because I think with diversity and with so many changes happening across the world, and then also with, you know, different tools and different technology and social media, it's going to require greater empathy and tolerance to have a more stable society.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And especially as things get more and more online, I mean, things are seemingly as online as they could be in terms of social media now, you know, compared to when we grew up. But it's really easy to be a keyboard warrior.
So yeah,
you know, to jump on there and troll people or get in arguments with people, and be safe behind your screen. And you know, that I think empathy is going to be very important with that, because it takes just an additional amount of empathy to be able to put yourself in somebody else's shoes when you're not standing right in front of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I wanted to go back to something you said a couple minutes ago, that you were mentioning that, you know, spending less time with kids can be detrimental. And that's something that Lizzie and I have thought a lot about and talked about too. You know, there's so many people who, and certainly like single parents, who are working 1, 2, 3 jobs, right? And even some co-parents who are both working full time. You know, kids have a very different sleep schedule from adults, I have learned. Our daughter, for example, goes to sleep anywhere between 6:45 and 7:30 on a given night. And she wakes up ideally at 7 a.m. That's the goal. Doesn't always happen that way. Sometimes it's 3 o'clock, sometimes it's 5. But, you know, for somebody who's working full time, or parents who are working full time, you know, if a kid wakes up at 7 and they got to be at work at 9, that leaves you maybe an hour in the morning to be together. And then if you're not getting off till 5 or 6, then you've got maybe an hour in the evening to be together. Now, over the course of multiple years, I think that really adds up to be a detriment to a child's experience and their kind of in their formative years.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more on that. I think getting the time off, the Family Medical Leave Act, and I think time off from work, I think it's the best thing that has happened to corporate America. A lot of CEOs and you know, pro-capitalists would say, oh, it reduces productivity and whatnot. And I would disagree with that. I would think that, I think actually it can increase productivity. I feel that I'm doing more now than I did when I didn't have a child. Actually, I think this whole idea of podcasting and doing more, I think it gave me a purpose in life. And I feel that I'm producing more than I did. And again, I was a very, you've known me my entire life. I've never been the type to, you know, sit around and not have, you know, something going. But I've noticed that it's taken off to the next level. And I'm excited for that. Did you notice that too? Or where your productivity and efficiency got better? Or what did you notice any changes in your performance in your work as well? Or What did you notice in that regards?
I think I may be the exception to the rule here, you know, because we have had such a difficult time with baby sleep. And let me just take a very quick tangent to say whoever came up with the phrase sleep like a baby is an asshole and doesn't know what they're talking about, or it means something completely different from what people usually think it means. Because we've had a different experience with that. So I'll just say that it's been difficult to be performing at the top level and to be productive when I have had fewer full nights sleep in the past year and a half of my life than I ever have before. And it's all for a good purpose, right? Like, it's not like it's an overall negative thing, and I don't want to take it for granted, right? There are certainly people out there who would give anything for a hard sleepless night with their little one because they may not have that option, whatever the case may be. But just the raw facts are sleep is really important for kids and for adults. And if I'm not getting a full night's rest, then it's harder for me to be productive the next day.
Yeah.
So that's generally been my experience so far.
Yeah. I think I'll experience that. Talk to me in you know, 20 more weeks. I might have a different opinion. I guess I'm still in that honeymoon phase of, we're having a baby and, you know, I'm doing better and, you know, I'm seeing all these things happen. But I talk to me in 20 weeks and we'll see how things have changed. But
yeah, Lizzie and I have often joked that, you know, when we meet other people who have newly had a baby, I say normal people, like most people would say, oh, congratulations, that's so amazing. You know, what sort of milestones is your kid hitting and that sort of thing? And really what we want to know is, how are you guys sleeping? How's that going for you? Are you sleeping? Just looking for some sort of relation, you know.
It's like trauma.
See if other people are having see if some other people are having the same experience as us. And we know that there are plenty of people who have that experience out there. But the interesting thing is we have found that like our parents and other people of that age who have adult children now, in other words, who were in the baby stage like 20, 30, 40 years ago, they just don't remember. You know, they, and I think that's a coping mechanism, really. They just don't remember the difficult times. And I think that's not just applicable to raising a child, just kind of human nature. But, you know, they'll say something like, oh, just stay out a little bit later. You can put the baby down half an hour later. And when they're just not in that world, you know, it's just a different language and they just either don't remember or didn't have that experience.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think it's probably suppression of those negative memories. And I think I guess my question to you is, what advice would you give to me and then to other new dads that are, you know, in this, you know, they're in the pregnancy stage? Would it be to get more sleep now because it's, you're not going to get much later, or that, and what other advice would you give?
Well, unfortunately, I don't think you can bank sleep like that. I'm not a sleep scientist or anything, but I'm fairly certain that it doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
But you know, I would say don't take it for granted, because you will miss it for a certain period of time, probably. You know, the other thing I would say is our experience has been that whatever suggestions other people give us or give you, they might just not work. You know, every kid is different, and what works for one family is not going to work for the other, you know? And, but I will say on the topic of sleep, what has helped us tremendously, at least on the nap side of things, because I didn't know this, but babies up to like, even, I mean, our daughter was, she just transitioned from two to one nap, like two naps to one nap a day, not too long ago. And she's 16 months now. And there was a certain period of time where she was younger, where she was doing like three, four, five naps a day. And what we found was that there is this thing called a sleep window or a wake window. It's essentially the baby's circadian rhythm throughout the 24 hours. And the goal is to align their nap times with their natural circadian rhythm, because that just makes things so much easier. And not to shill for any companies or anything, but there is a particular company called Owlet, Owlet, that makes what's called a dream sock. And it's this little sensor thing that you put on the baby's foot, and it measures things like heart rate, oxygen saturation, and like it can somehow tell whether or not the baby is awake or asleep. But what it also does, their app at least, is it predicts their next sleep time. And we found that when we started to try to align to that schedule, our days, like our nap experience, got 1,000 times better. And our daughter got way less cranky. She was sleeping better during the day. And so, yeah, wake windows.
Wake windows.
That helps us a lot.
That's okay. I actually wrote that down. What's the what is it called? The product? What is it? It's a sock.
We use the sock at night when she's sleeping, and it will also like, it'll fire off an alarm to your phone or to the little base station if it detects anything wrong, like if the O2 saturation goes below a certain amount, if their pulse goes below a certain amount. It's actually FDA approved. You should look into it, but it's called the Owlet Dream Sock. And yeah, it's great for peace of mind. You know, in the middle of the night, you get those scaries where, oh my God, is the baby okay? You can just check the app without waking up the baby. And you see, I can see the baby's pulse and the O2 sat right here.
That's awesome. Yeah, I'm looking it up right now, actually. And that's pretty cool. A little pricey, but in the grand scheme of things, it says it's trusted by 1 million parents. That's pretty impressive, actually.
If that 1 million doesn't include Lizzie and I, then make it 1,000,002, because we trust it and it's been very helpful.
That's awesome. Yeah. I take sleep medication to knock out, because I am a night owl, but it's been amazing to be on a medication to help me sleep. But I do know that when the baby is born, I'm going to have to cut back and, you know, kind of do my night shifts with the baby so Madison can get rest. But I think this seems like a pretty good idea, actually. I will say I'm guilty of, I took a nap today and it was 3 hours long. And,
man, that's a sleep. That isn't a nap.
Okay. You know what? I think there's a cultural difference here. We should probably wrap it up soon, but I was going to say, Madison said the same thing. When I met her, you know, I was like, oh, I'm going to take a nap. And we were long distance at the time. And she didn't get a message from me like 4 hours, you know. And she said, what happened to you? I was like, oh, I was just taking a nap. And she said, A nap? How many REM cycles did you get into that? And she's, you know, I guess in the Western culture is, you know, a nap is what would you say? How many minutes or hours?
Well, I'm probably the wrong person to ask because my mantra, at least back in the day, used to be you all sleep when I'm dead. And yeah. I think that saying is coming back to bite me in the ass now. But but if I sleep more than like 20 or 30 minutes for a nap during the day, I'm useless the rest of the day. I'm super groggy. It just doesn't work for me. So a nap for me is like 20 to 30 minutes.
Oh, man. A nap for me is at least 2 hours. And I don't do it every day, obviously, because there's no way I could hold a job and, you know, family and whatnot, sleeping 2 hours in the middle of the day. But on a Saturday and Sunday, if I can, one of those days, if I can get a nap in, and it's usually a pretty long, like I can knock out for 3 hours. And I think, you know, that's just how I grew up, you know. Even I think in some countries they call it siesta, you know, the midday nap or whatever. In India, it was the same thing. I don't know if everyone in India does like 3 to 4 hours, but I do know that the community that I grew up in, it was like a thing that on a Saturday afternoon, you would go to a temple on a Saturday and Sunday, and you'd come home around like 1, and then from like 1 to 5, you know, again, you could be 3 hours or 4 hours. Your entire family just slept, and you turned on the air conditioner. Or, you know, and your fans and whatnot, and made the house really cool, and you knocked out, and then you woke up, and, you know, you got some stuff done, and then around, I think it was like around 7, you'd get food ready, and then you'd eat food by 8, and then you're up for a couple more hours, and you go to bed to like a, then you'd stay up a little bit longer, because, you know, I think in most your, I would say more and more Asian countries, you would stay up a little bit longer. I know in India for sure. Then you go to bed like around 11. Then, you know, start your day the next day at like 7 a.m. again or 6:30, so that you still get in your 7 hours sleep. But yeah, I knocked out today and Madison was like, you were knocked out for 4 hours and, our whole Saturday's gone now. I was like, oh, well, to me, it was a Saturday well worth spent. But anyways, thanks for joining the show, man. I'm excited for our podcast, and hopefully we'll get some audience eventually. Right now it's just you and my dog and Madison.
Yeah, I know Lizzie's curious to listen to it. My guess is that, you know, she'll probably make it 20 minutes in and then go on to something else, but that's okay.
I'll put it at a fast speed or something when I upload it. That way it's not too long. But yeah, we'll see. Thanks for joining. And when do you want to do this again? When should our listeners expect us to do this again?
Our listeners. Yeah, right now it's when should our wives expect us to be unavailable for another couple of hours. I don't know. Let's talk about it. I think, you know, in a couple of weeks, maybe two, three, four weeks somewhere, I think probably would be more ideal to find a morning, perhaps.
Yes, where we could do it.
you know, where Lizzie doesn't have to be. Well, yeah, we'll just leave it at that. Maybe it would be better to do it in the morning. But yeah, we'll talk about it, and we'll keep the listeners on their toes for the time being until we get a more regular cadence.
Our listeners, as in our wives. All right, man. Thanks, bud. You have a great rest of your night. Bye bye.
All right, you too. Thanks. Bye.